Welcome to Saturday Night at the Movies, the podcast that celebrates classic, cult, and current films and the people that made them and many other aspects of pop culture. I'm your host, Steve Rubin. Our producer's Ben Shrewsbury, and our signature theme was composed by Greg Lehrhoff. Here it's always Saturday night, and our mission is to chronicle film and pop cultural history one memory at a time. Tonight, our guest is writer-director Ron Maxwell, whom I interviewed 14 years ago for the updated edition of my first book, Combat Films, American Realism, 1945 to 2010. The subject of that interview was my chapter on his epic historical film, Gettysburg, which I consider one of the greatest and most realistic war films ever produced. Welcome, Ron.
Good to be with you.
You know, it's interesting. A lot of your history in getting things done deals with the Civil War, not only Gettysburg, but Gods and Monsters, its prequel. Here it is, 2024. And I walked past the theater marquee the other day, and it said Civil War on it. And there's a movie in the theatrical marketplace right now about a contemporary Civil War in America. I don't want to get too heavily into politics because that's not what my show is about. But do you actually think it's possible for America to have another Civil War?
Well, luckily for us, our ancestors over the last 200 plus years have constructed institutions which are rather unique in all of human history, which is why we shouldn't take them for granted, because these institutions that were put together when the Constitution was fashioned were contrived because those men who put that Constitution together were acutely aware of the world they had inherited, a world that was almost nonstop war, a world that was ruled by despots, a world that had just come out of nonstop religious fanatical warfare, Protestants killing Catholics, Catholics killing other Catholics, the whole religious wars that took place in Europe, which decimated the population and ruined European cultures, that was very close to that generation in the 18th century, which is why they constructed the Constitution the way they did, with a separation of powers, so that power would not devolve into an individual. They were afraid of the monarchy. And you can read in the constitutional debates whether you should have one president or two presidents or a triumvirate. They were really concerned about concentrating power into the hands of an individual. So as a result, we have this separation of powers, which is rather unique, especially at the time. At the time of the 18th century, probably the only cultures that were anything like that were the Dutch Republic and the Swiss Republic. Otherwise, the whole rest of the world was in a state of despotism of various degrees. So they built these this constitution, this framework, so that we could disagree amicably in a democracy, small d. We know it's not a pure democracy like the Athenian democracy. We understand that. So when I use the term democracy, I'm referring to the way that modern democratic governments work. What's built in is the opportunity to disagree, and to disagree vehemently and with passion. And that's part of why this system works, but it's also what frustrates us. And it's frustrated human beings from time immemorial. So when we're constantly having to listen to people with whom we disagree, sometimes whom we regard with contempt and derision, we think, well, maybe it's preferable to have our king, the strong man who will impose our values on everyone else. And it's very tempting, and the tempting for the despot, we've seen it play out all across the world. We saw it play out with murderous consequences in Europe in the 20th century, the communist version of the despotism and the fascist version of the despotism. We know where that leads. We should know where that leads. And so the other system, which is our system, depends on our ability to disagree agreeably, even though it is obviously infuriating a lot of the time. So this new film that's come out called The Civil War, I haven't seen it yet, but I've read a few things about it. I guess I'll see it. It seems like it's almost like a must-see film in terms of the zeitgeist. Sure, there are elements in democratic societies, not just ours, but in Western Europe, in other democratic societies, in India, that seek to pull the fabric of the constitutional republic apart. And it's a form, it's a variation of intolerance. I am so sick and tired of listening to these people who are attacking my culture or attacking my belief system, wherever you are on the spectrum, that I'm done talking. I want to settle it with violence. Well, people who talk that way obviously have zero knowledge of the American Civil War. I mean, they're utterly ignorant of what our country went through. The same people who talk that way would probably be screaming if they stubbed their toe. And we're not talking about stubbing toes. We're talking about massive violence, massive death and dislocation if a modern society slides into civil war. We don't have to even look to our own civil war. We can look at what happened in when Yugoslavia disintegrated in the 1990s. You cannot unleash the barbarism of humanity. We humans are the same today than we were 1,000 years ago or 1,000,000 years ago. We're Homo sapiens. And we know how violent and destructive Homo sapiens can be, probably the most violent and destructive species on the planet. So we need law and order and civilized government to hold it all together so that our passions do not run away with us. You ask me, how close are we to a civil war in this country? I don't think we're that close. I think most people are reasonable. They understand that no matter how frustrating things are at the moment, the resort to violence is immeasurably worse. Nothing will get better. Everything will get worse if we start to even contemplate going down that road.
You know, in 1861, when the South seceded, virtually the entire South became a huge army. It seems to me that you cannot duplicate that today. I don't think I'm being naive by saying that the people who preach violence are a very small minority of people in the country. And we have the rule of law. And even in very, very extremist situations, the sheriffs, the police officers, it seems they do stand by the law. And they would fight these insurrectionists. So that, I'm confident that it wouldn't happen.
Yes, you can never say never, because we're in a world where things are volatile. We're in a world where it's easy for people to get lethal arms. So sure, it's possible it has. But I think those of us who know history, who have studied history, are perhaps have a higher level of responsibility to our fellow citizens to remind people. Certainly the three movies I made about the Civil War that take place during the American Civil War, Gettysburg. Thank you so much for your compliment at the opening of this. Gettysburg, which was released 30 years ago. Gods and Generals, which was released 20 years ago. And Copperhead, which was released 10 years ago. Altogether, they're windows into the Civil War. And I think there's a lot of moving parts there. And I was concentrating, as a matter of choice, on the honorable people who got drawn into that conflict, originally based on Michael Schara's book. So I followed the characters that he chose. But if you look at those characters, the characters that move through those three films, they're honorable people. And they find themselves in this awful dilemma, and they try to behave honorably. My father was such a person. He was a veteran of World War II. He enlisted. He fought in World War II. World War II is another catastrophic war. We cannot overstate what a catastrophe it was. And yet people, honorable people like my dad, were drawn into it. So I was never interested as a filmmaker in the sadists, the people who enjoy hurting other people, the people who love to kill other people. There are such people in wars. We know that. We're seeing it now in going on in Ukraine, for example. There are people who enjoy that kind of thing. And films will be made about those kind of sadist and murderous types. What I concentrated on in my three films are the people who are caught up in it as a result of politicians making mistakes. So in these films, Jackson and Lee and Hancock and Chamberlain, they didn't instigate the war. They didn't start the war. It was left to them to kind of settle things at that point, because people who should have settled it amicably, people who should have settled it nonviolently, failed to do so. And these people who acted irresponsibly were both in the North and the South. And in the previous 30, 40 years leading up to the 1860s, they allowed things to get worse and worse and worse. They dehumanized one another. And you're quite right, the point you made, Stephen, about it was more of a sectional war, which was different than when we think of modern civil wars. Communities are torn apart. Families are torn apart. The American Civil War was largely sectional, the North versus the South. And so the Southerners dehumanized the abolitionists and the Unionists, and the Unionists and the abolitionists dehumanized the Southerners and the secessionists. And it festered for more than two generations when it got to the point where they could actually shoot at each other. And as we know, then it went on for 4 years, a great big bloodbath that endured for 4 years with more than a century. We're still living with the consequences. So if for no other reason, if we can learn nothing else in the American Civil War, is we shouldn't have gone there. And please God, we should never go there again.
You know, in rereading our interview from 2010, you were talking about the challenges that faced you in getting Gettysburg off the ground. You had a very long movie that had logistical challenges, enormous logistical challenges. It was about the Civil War, which, of course, has always been a very hot point for discussion. And then there were no women in the show. So you had a lot of projection. You were also trying to sell this movie at a time when Star Wars had come out, and everything was obsessive about science fiction, fantasy getaways. And I'm thinking that today, it's 40 years later, because you were doing it in the 80s, Hollywood filmmakers who want to do epic historical films, like Oppenheimer recently, which of course got a lot of attention, are faced with the fact that most of the money in Hollywood is going to Marvel and DC superhero movies, which soak up an enormous amount of capital. How I would assume, and I'm involved in trying to do history as well as a filmmaker, how challenging is it to get anything done anymore?
Well, it's obviously very challenging for all of us filmmakers. Oppenheimer was able to be done because it's a filmmaker at the top of his game with big box office successes behind him. So he has more of an opportunity. But those filmmakers, you can count them on the fingers of one hand. We know who they are. They can pretty much make movies at that level. But they've earned it. They've earned it over a decade of big box office and big critical acclaim. But for the rest of us, it's really tough because, as you say, the studio system, such as it is, we know it's in a state of flux. They're all playing the Marvel game, more or less, big super budgets, so where's the indie cinema? I've been a member of the Academy since the early '90s, so I get, you know, the movies to look at and consider every year for nomination, and I see a lot of them, my wife and I. Between, you know, late September and late December. And what I'm really impressed with year after year is how many really good independent films are made. So there's still, it tells me there's still space. We can name the titles we really liked. I think Tar a couple of seasons ago was an independent film. Really, really fine work. This last year, American Fiction was extraordinary. Every year there's a handful, and I always marvel at, wow, how did they get that one together? But it keeps me going. I'm sure it keeps a lot of other filmmakers going to say, you see, this is possible. You can still make a medium-sized budget or even a relatively low-budget film, and it's not formulaic. It's not cookie cutter. It's the result of one or two or three or a handful of filmmakers who willed it into existence through their tenacity. And then we look behind the scenes. Oftentimes, these scripts have been knocking around for a decade or more that a filmmaker has been wanting to do it. So it's always been a tough business. I think another thing that we American filmmakers have had an extra hurdle imposed on us. If you look at what's produced and what comes through on the streamers now, Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, et cetera, and look at the ones that are historical films, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say 95% are European stories. Endless stories about Edwardian England, Elizabethan England, Victorian England, which I love as a consumer, but where's the Mark Twain? Where's the Eudora Welty? Where are the American stories? Now, there are a few that squeak through, but the reason for that, it's not a mystery, and not just now, but going back decades in American cinema, is because the European cinema is heavily subsidized. That's number one. So those scripts, when they want to get made, they're starting with a huge advantage. They're coming in with 20, 30, 40, 50, 60% of the budget. Well, if a Hollywood distributor is looking at a film that's got 60, 70% of the budget already committed from France or England or Scotland, and the American story about whatever, guess which one they're going to do? It's just strictly, it's an economic decision. Another thing that adds into that is the audiences in Europe demand this. There's a huge appetite, whether you're talking about Germany or Italy or whatever country we look at, for the stories of their history. It's not considered esoteric it's very much mainstream. So for all those reasons taken together, many, many movies about European history, very few about American history. And that's why it has to do with the subsidies in Europe. And another thing that happens is all those filmmakers end up doing it over and over again. So that when American studio wants to do a historical picture, well, they look at the directors available, and the ones who've done all the historical pictures are Brits, you know, or Germans, because they've done a lot. They're doing it all the time. So the whole thing mitigates against American filmmakers doing American subjects. But how we're not dismayed. Witness,
well, yeah. Ron Finn, who's done three. I mean, Gettysburg. Let's see, I went to the Century City Theaters in 93 and saw it there on the big screen. It was, maybe once before I'd seen a four-hour movie. I think I sat through Cleopatra once. But I sat through your movie for 4 hours. And afterwards, I said I probably could have sat through 8 hours. It was one of the most riveting, most compelling, epic films I'd ever seen. But I think the key for my money to Gettysburg is your casting. Now, the old adage is a director's job is 80% casting. I think you have one of the great casts of all time. And I think that you picked actors who really filled the screen. And as you pointed out, in my original interview, you pointed out that this is a movie that you have nobody to root against. When you're with the Confederates, you sympathize with their plight. When you're with the Union, you sympathize with their plight. And I think that's a key part of the effectiveness. That was probably Shara's book that gave you that basis, correct?
Yes. And when you talk about casting, you know, when I think of the Godfather trilogy, you see in those films the very best Italian-American actors of their generation. They're all there in those movies. And I like to think of Gettysburg, which was made almost 20 years after the first Godfather. We have the very best of all the non-Italian-American actors left. So So yes, I agree with you. It's an extraordinary cast. Every single one of those actors showed up and delivered. It's a wonder to behold. Even when we saw the film, we saw the director's cut list this past November. There was a screening at the Majestic Theater in Gettysburg for the 30th anniversary. Tom Berenger came. A lot of the cast showed up. More than 20 actors came and some crew members. And to see it again, I agree with you. One of the things I was thinking watching it is, damn, what a great bunch of actors.
Yeah, and I'm reminded of the travail in trying to attract actors. Now, you've got to tell the story, because it's one of my favorite stories of yours, that before Jeff Daniels came to the part of Colonel Chamberlain, you had another actor in mind. You've got to tell that story, because I think it's absolutely fascinating.
Well, it's I'll start with the obvious, that, you know, no one could have played Chamberlain better than Jeff Daniels. I mean, he delivered an extraordinary performance. I think it's one for the ages. But he wasn't our first choice. I mean, this is a story you hear often in the history of Hollywood movies. As you say, correctly, casting is 80% of any movie. You get it wrong, and it's really hard to make a good movie after that initial mistake. So we knew we had to nail it on the casting. And in Chamberlain, you needed someone who could embody the professorial quality and also the hard steel of the soldier, and also looked somewhat like Chamberlain. Not exactly, but somebody who you could believe was Joshua Chamberlain in the 1860s. So when you got down to a very short list, especially since the studio, which was TNT at the time, remember, when we were planning it, it was planned as a miniseries, which explains why we went out there with a five-hour script. It was a very small group who were in that category, already a name, quote unquote, a marquee name that they wanted for the series. But I was told about an actor who I was told you should see this guy, Ron. He just came over from Australia and he's done some work there, but he's interesting. You should see him. A friend of mine called me, told me about him. I forget who it was now. So I got in touch with him. He came over to read at my place in Hidden Hills. I was really impressed. Really, really impressed. I said, you know, I think you can do this, but I'm going to have to sell you to the studio. So learn these two arias. You'll know that in Gettysburg has arias, which are, you know, individual characters make speeches. And in the 12 years before we set it up at Turner, some executives would look at the script and they'd see one character talking for like three pages. And they say, Ron, you can't do this. You can't do this in a movie. And I would often tell them the story as a response. I said, did you see Sophie's Choice? And they go, oh, yeah, yeah. I said, the scene at the end when Meryl Streep's character is talking about her choice, the climax of the movie. Are you aware of how long she's talking? They're not. Are you aware how many pages that was in the script? They're not. Of course they're not. It's a silly thing that when people look at a script, they think, well, someone's talking too much. No, it's not about who's talking or who's not talking. It's about, will the audience be riveted to what's going on? So I ignored over decades this criticism that people are talking too long. So I wanted, in the hands of great actors, it soars. Of course it does. So this actor learned two of these arias, committed them to memory, and I got a blue uniform for him and a hat. And he came back a week later, a few days later, and we did a screen test with my handheld video camera, which in those days you had to put videotape in. It's before digital. And he nailed it. He just nailed it. We weren't in Gettysburg. We were in my semi-tropical backyard in Hidden Hills, Southern California. And I went in and I showed it to the executive at TNT. And he said, why are you showing me this? I said, well, it speaks for itself. He said, Ron, I told you we want a name. So, you know, let's drop it. So I kept on looking for other parts. I met with Tom Berenger about playing Longstreet. We were getting in touch with Martin Sheen about playing Lee and other actors. But I didn't really look for anybody else for Chamberlain because I thought, this is it. I never find anybody better. And I don't know, 10 days or so went by and the executive said, where are we with Chamberlain? I said, that tape I brought you a while back, I think we should look at it again because the more I've thought about it, the more I think this is our guy. We can't do better. And, you know, we'll get other names around him. We'll get 3 or 4 or 5 other names. And he said to me, the executive said, and I don't want to mention his name because let bygones be bygones. He's not in the business anymore anyway. But he said, if you mention his name one more time, I'm canceling the project. And he was deadly serious. Now, in those days, I didn't have the relationship with Ted Turner that I subsequently developed after the movie was made. And Ted and I became great friends and we did Gods and Generals together and we're dear friends to this day. I love Ted Turner, but I didn't have the relationship then. So when that executive made that comment, I had to take it seriously. Well, that actor was Russell Crowe.
And when you told me that, I nearly fell off my chair. I mean, you know, it's let's see, 7 years later, Russell Crowe makes Gladiator and just astounds the world. Don't get me wrong. I think Daniels was brilliant. And in fact, I remember you saying to me that when you got Daniels, you had one thing you told him, to bring the steel. I thought that was a great quote because obviously amongst many things, Chamberlain has to have the total bravado to command Little Round Top and keep his men firing. And we'll talk about that in a second, but interesting how some actors just don't, it was too early for Crowe. Crowe had not, you know, reached his boiling point. He was still simmering, but it is an interesting story to think of Russell Crowe as Chamberlain. It would have added another dimension, but that's in hindsight. I want to mention another actor that I think is part of the steelworks of, well, there's so many of them, but I wanted to bring up Richard Jordan because Richard Jordan is so wonderful in the role of Louis Armistead. And you had known Richard, right?
Richard was, until the day he died in the summer of 92, when we were in post-production, one of my very dearest, closest friends. We'd met sometime in the 70s, when I was working at WNET Channel 13 in New York. I was there between 74 and 78. So sometime in there we met. We both were living in Manhattan. And we just developed a great friendship. When I acquired the rights to the Killer Angels in 78, I remember Richard was very excited because he knew the book. And I gave him the first draft of the screenplay. He gave me copious notes. He really spent a lot of time with me. He was a wonderful colleague. You know, we all have friends and colleagues in the industry that we share scripts with, you know, but works in both directions. Will you read this, Ron? And or early cuts of the film, come and see this. Because you know your friends are going to be honest with you. Your good friends are on your side, and people who are on your side as a human being, as an artist, are going to be honest with you, and they're going to be highly critical and tell you where you're going off the rails, tell you when you're on the right track. And we had those discussions always about all sorts of projects, but certainly on this one. At one point, I think it was 80 or 81, I think it was 80 maybe. By that time, we were both living in Los Angeles. We had both had moved out of New York. I was, forget where I was in LA, but he was living in Carbon Canyon with Blair Brown at the time. They had a son together. I can't imagine how old he is now. We decided to have a reading. I needed to hear it. And I hadn't heard it. Richard and another good friend of mine, Hal Holbrook, who's also passed away, but more recently, Hal and Richard and Blair organized, they got on the phone, they called, must have been 20 actors, 20 or so actors. We all came on an evening, and they got the Mark Taper Forum backstage, a night that was dark, there was no show going on. And I just brought on a big buffet, and we met at 5 or 6 in the afternoon, and we were there till like midnight with a little break for sandwiches. And we read through the script, all 5 hours of it.
Did you take a bathroom break?
we took a kind of where the intermission is. We took a break and sandwiches. And it was, I mean, a cross section of, you know, the really wonderful actors who were working in film and theater in those days. And at the end of the evening, after the last stage directions were read, one of the actors was reading the stage directions, the room got quiet, and the quiet lingered. And then they all broke into a sustained applause. And even though I had been taking notes, many, many notes, because when you hear things, you learn so much, as opposed to when it's just on the page. Redundancy and things that need to be reworked, et cetera, et cetera. But I knew that night in 1980 that I was going to make the movie. There was no doubt in my mind. We didn't film it until the summer of 92, 12 years later. But it was that evening that I gained the conviction from the way those actors made it come alive. So Richard was instrumental, really, in helping to bring this project alive. So when I wrote the part of Armistead, I wrote it specifically with him in mind. And even though the Gettysburg screenplay adheres very closely to the novel, there are scenes in it which are not in the novel. And among the scenes which I wrote, one of them is the scene with Armistead and Fremantle when they're having a conversation when the troops are assembling in the tree line before Pickett's charge. That's not in the book. So I wrote that specifically for Richard, who was going to play Armistead.
That's when Armistead talks about all the people who are related to famous people in the Confederate ranks, which I thought was quite fascinating. Just very interesting. Yeah. And, you know, it's so tragic that we lost Richard so early. He was ailing during the filming, wasn't he?
He was okay during the filming. What killed him was a severe brain tumor that came on very fast. There was no inkling of him being sick in any way. And it was a grueling shoot. I mean, physically grueling. It was hot and humid, very hot, humid summer. We were working 6-day weeks, which it's inconceivable to me now to do a 6-day week. But we're 6-day weeks. Long days, a phenomenal amount of setups per day. It was an extraordinary crew, an extraordinary effort on the part of the cast and crew and reenactors. It was a hazardous set because we had cannons and muskets, all real weapons, even though they had blanks. They can kill you at short range. So we had a wonderful first AD, wonderful crew, safety, safety, safety. Thank God no one was hurt. No one was injured. But Richard, you know, he barreled through that, and it was very demanding for him. Think of what he was doing in Pickett's Charge, guns being fired. It was grueling. And you know, the scene where he shot, but he got through it. It wasn't until we were deep in post-production, winter and spring, the spring of 92, we filmed the summer of 92. So we're talking about the spring of 93. That he came to see me one day and he said, "Ron, I'm scared to death." And I said, "What?" I had a place in Hidden Hills, as I say, and he drove across the Malibu Canyon to see me. And he said, "I have a brain tumor and they're telling me I have to have it removed and I'm in constant pain. I can't escape the pain." Well, it was heartbreaking to hear this. And I could see, looking into his eyes, real fear. I've rarely seen that in anyone's eyes in my life. And about a week later, he had the operation. And then about, I forget how many weeks later, 3 weeks or so later, I got a call from his then girlfriend. He and Blair had broken up before. And she said, come on over. Richard would like to see you. And I went over to Malibu Canyon, and he couldn't speak. Stephen, this was an extraordinary moment. Because here, one of the most articulate, eloquent Shakespearean actors who could do, you know, playing Macbeth. He did play Macbeth, as a matter of fact, in the New York Shakespeare Festival, was speechless. That part of his brain had been affected, but he still thought he was going to live. And I think within 2 months after I saw him, he was gone. It's a great loss for me because he was a great friend. I miss him every day. I'm not exaggerating. I miss him every day. But also a great loss for Hollywood because he was in the prime of his career. God knows what he would have done. But we must be thankful that the last performance he was in was Gettysburg, and he knocked it out of the park.
He gave us a great gift. He definitely gave us good. Now, there's another actor I want to mention that I also think is wonderful, and that is Sam Elliott. I remember the first time you see Sam Elliott, he's leading a cavalry column, and it was the first realization that you guys were not stinting on size, because it's not 10 guys, it's 30 or 40 guys in a column of cavalry. And Sam Elliott brought such presence to the role and steel, as we said, that same steel quality that Chamberlain has. Tell us a little bit about Sam from your point of view.
Well, as I said, in that early casting process, it was one of the roles where we wanted to have a marquee name, as well as being obviously right for it. And so I think in that case, Sam was the number one person we were going after, and it worked out. And by the time he got to the set, not just Sam Elliott, but every single one of those actors, even if they just had worked for a day, they had read everything. They had read the regimental histories, the biographies. They had read everything. So they came completely prepared to the extent that they could be prepared about the character. Then on these, when I do a film, Stephen, I like to have rehearsal time, because that's the time to be free and to experiment and to be silly and crazy and wacky and take chances and go down this road or that road. You can't do that when you're shooting. There's too much pressure when you're any movie, not just a big epic like this with thousands of extras and a huge budget. You just don't have the time to do that when you're shooting. So it's very important to do the actor's work, the scene breakdowns kind of thing you're doing in acting class, and the kind of thing you would do in a stage play, whatever, to what's going on here, what's the subtext, what's really happening in the scene. So all that rehearsal time is important. So on Gettysburg, also on Gods and Generals, because there's so many moving parts, I like to have a week of rehearsal with the actors to explore this. And it was a big script, as we said. It's like two movies, 5 hours of material. And another week for everything else. But what I mean everything else? To match the actor with the horse. We're dealing with not just what the characters look like, we're dealing with what the horses look like. We have photography of the horses. And of course, the officer corps of both armies had the most magnificent horses available in the 19th century, when that was the mode of travel. It was it. There were a few trains, but mostly horses moved everyone around. So the second week was about acclimatizing the cast with their horses, working with the wranglers, getting them used to weapons that they had to carry, getting their wardrobe right, that kind of thing. But that first week, which was so instrumental, which was breaking down the scenes, and then me figuring out with my cameraman how we're going to shoot it. Is it in one? Is it in two? Is it in five? Is it a tracking shot? What are we? How are we telling this story? So you can imagine that's a lot of rehearsal you got to cram into 1 week, but we managed to do it. And in that week, you know, we worked with Sam and the people in his company. So that when we came back, and the movie was like two schedules in one, because other than the scene where Tom Chamberlain meets Armistead, who has just been shot, other than that scene, no Confederate characters are ever in a scene with Yankee characters in the entire film. So first, when we started shooting, after the rehearsal weeks, all the Yankees went home. They went back to L.A., New York, Wisconsin, wherever they lived. They were gone. They came back 6 weeks later, or 5 weeks later, whatever it was. So the first part of the film were the Confederates. And then we filmed that part. Then they all went home. They were wrapped out. All the Yankees came in for the second movie, so to speak. So imagine by the time Sam Elliott came back, we had rehearsed a month or 6 weeks before. But thank God we did all that stuff, because when we got there on the day, we knew what we were doing. Everyone knew what we were doing. We were following a plan. And the nice thing about that, as any filmmaker knows, is when the more you've prepped, the more spontaneous you can be. It's almost an irony, but it's true. Because you have the confidence of knowing what you're doing. You have the confidence that you've gone down these roads. You've made the major choices. So that liberates you, if you want, to completely change your mind on the day. If you or an actor gets inspired, I just say, hey, go for it. Don't worry. Go for it.
You mentioned to me in our original interview that whereas in the actual battle, both sides were firing at each other simultaneously, obviously, but as filmmaking, you could only fire, the Union would fire their guns, and there were no Confederates in front of them, because that could have become very dangerous, even though they were firing blanks. And then when the Confederates are firing, you said the Union weren't there. Is that true that you didn't, like at Little Round Top, you had to have both armies there, because they end up doing some hand-to-hand fighting, but when they're shooting, you don't shoot with people in front of you, correct?
Let me qualify that. We shot about 60 or 70% of the film inside the boundaries of the National Historical Park of Gettysburg. Whenever we were filming inside the park, we had to abide by their rules. One of the rules was we would not interrupt the flow of tourism. And that worked out, because wherever we were filming, we put tape around the area like you'd see at an accident site or a crime site. But we didn't block the roads. So when the tourists came by, they oftentimes stopped and went up to the tape and watched. We never had to redo a take because of noise from tourists. Everyone was so respectful. And there were tens of thousands of tourists who came through during that summer. It just went swimmingly. The other restriction we had put on us had to do with safety. They didn't want opposing fire in the same shot, because opposing fire in the same shot, they were worried about people getting hurt, and they didn't want that liability. So we agreed to that. So whenever we were on the property of Gettysburg, you don't see Confederates and Yankees shooting at each other in the same shot. However, the other 40% of the movie, 40% or so, we shot on private property west of Gettysburg. That's where we built the stone wall of the angle, because at the angle, at the end of Pickett's Charge, there's hand-to-hand combat. They're shooting point blank range. That was done on private property. Little Round Top battle. You're right. That's almost point blank range. Bayonet, hand-to-hand fighting. That was private property. The battle among the boulders in Devil's Den, the same thing. You see Confederates and Yankees shooting each other, hand-to-hand combat, bayonets. So there's a few times in the movie when you see opposing fire, but it's always on private property. And when it gets right down to the hand-to-hand combat, that's meticulously choreographed with stunt directors and stuntmen. I mean, that's not reenactors, because you'd kill somebody. Another thing that was very hazardous was, you know, if you had rubber bayonets, they flop around. So we have to go with the steel bayonets. So it's a testament, I think, to the entire crew, the Directors Guild, first AD, second AD, the stunt coordinator and the stuntmen, that we just said, we're not rushing a shot. We're not going to hurt anybody. We're not going to hurt an animal. It was very important. Every morning we had a meeting about this. I would say, as director, there's no shot in this film worth hurting anybody or an animal. And we had lots of horses on Gettysburg, and the wrangler knew that if the horses got too hot and they needed to be watered, he knew he was supposed to come to me and tell me. I didn't want a horse going down in this picture. I love horses. I love animals. So one time in the shoot, he came to me and he said, "Ron, you have one more take and I got to water the horses." I said, "Okay." I was hoping we would get, cut print. We're shooting on film in those days. Cut. I wanted to say cut print, but I couldn't because we didn't get it. So I said, cut. I called my first AD over and I said, "We need to take a 30-minute break to water the horses." We called the break. The crew sat down. The horses went away. They came back 30 minutes later. And the crew, two of the man and woman, were so proud that we had looked after the horses. So guess what? We finished our day's work on time. Everybody just jumped too. But in terms of the opposing fire, that happened on private property.
Right. Now, I would argue that the Battle of Little Round Top in Gettysburg is just one of the most riveting war scenes I've ever seen. And I was wondering, in deciding how to film it, were you influenced by any other war pictures you had seen in the past? Or was it, this is just your basic instinct to shoot it this way? I mean, we've all seen hundreds of war pictures over the years. Were you influenced by anyone?
Well, let me answer that in two parts. First of all, the war movies I like to watch, I see that the director and the stunt coordinator has gone to great lengths to replicate specifically the way soldiers were fighting in this or that battle in this or that epoch. Some movies don't do that, and it's kind of generic, and I get bored in a hurry. I think what the movies we really like, for many reasons, but one of the reasons is that when it gets to the action is specific to the time and the place and the tactics employed in that particular war, in that particular battle. So we're dealing with what historians call Napoleonic tactics. People in the middle of the 19th century were still fighting wars like the time of Napoleon a generation or two before. Some of the weapons had changed, and certainly during the war, there were repeating rifles, and later there were Gatling guns, and that really changed everything. But in the early parts of the war, they were still fighting almost the same way they were fighting at the Austerlitz. And how were people fighting? We wanted to be very specific in the how the people would form up and go into battle and use their weapons. Secondly, in Gettysburg, the three big battles we see in the film, the first cavalry engagement, and then the Little Round Top, and then Pickett's Charge, tactically they're different. Each one of those battles, on day one, day two, day three, they're different tactically. And so we had the military historians on the set. And so you're seeing three different kinds of fighting over the movie, because it's very specific how tactically they're using the armies. So that was something we really had to think through. Storyboard, all the action sequences in Gettysburg are storyboarded. Not the whole movie, not the dialogue scenes, but all the action scenes were meticulously storyboarded months before we got to the set. Now, obviously, I had been to the set. I'm talking about months before the crew got to the set, but I was at the set many times with my storyboard artist, and we did all that together before the crew and the company got to the set. And once again, as I alluded to before, that doesn't mean you have to slavishly adhere to it, but it's a guideline. The whole crew has the storyboards, your props and special effects and wranglers. Everybody knows what you're kind of striving for ahead of time. Now, the other way to answer your question is that the cinematographer, Case Van Ostrom, we've now done three movies together. So like on Copperhead, we hardly had to talk anymore. We could just grunt and look at each other, and we know what we have to do, because we have this symbiotic relationship now. We understand each other. But on the first movie, on Gettysburg, we were kind of getting to know each other, it worked out. But long before we got to the set, when I first decided that Case would be my cinematographer, we immediately started looking at war movies. We got prints. We were looking at them at the Warner lot. And we spent a good part of a month. I'm not saying every night, but often we looked at a whole bunch of films by Akira Kurosawa. We looked at Sergei Bondarchuk's films, the big Russian films he made, Waterloo and War and Peace. We looked at the big war movies that were done, big widescreen movies in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Paths of Glory.
Some of the works of Lewis Milestone, A Walk in the Sun, Pork Chop Hill, things like that.
Not those specific ones. We were looking more of the ones that were done 19th century, 18th century. Abel Gance's Napoleon. And we learned a lot. You watch those films, there's a lot you're going to learn in many levels. But in terms of cinematography, we learned some things. We learned that whenever anybody was using a long lens and they were panning, you couldn't watch it. You got nauseous. So right away we learned, okay, we're only going to use long lenses, meaning over 100 millimeter, if it's a POV through binoculars. So the only time you see long lenses being used in either Gettysburg or Gods and Generals is when it's a POV through field glasses. Then it could be 100 millimeter, 150 millimeter. The rest of the movie were on like much shorter lenses, because what you can't pan in a long lens. It kind of has a strobing effect. And so all sorts of things we learned, but that's one of them that I remember in particular.
Sure.
Another thing, Stephen, since it just came up in my mind, is how, for instance, Kurosawa moved groups of men across the screen. And if you remember, all his war movies, they have like flags attached to their uniforms. And what he did oftentimes is he would have the terrain would undulate. So you'd see soldiers coming up, soldiers going down. He used the terrain very effectively. And it was a way to create great variety and great impact, visual impact, and also suspense. So all that was very useful to us because we had to shoot many thousands of men in different situations. And, it informed the way we made the movie for sure. And it's a reminder that none of us is reinventing the wheel. Every filmmaker is standing on the shoulders of all the filmmakers who came before.
Well, it's interesting because now, thanks to digital technology, you can have an army of 10,000 men and they're not human. They're little digital effects in the background that are so realistic. I mean, the program has gotten so specific that each of those individual digital characters have a unique movement to them. It's numbing. I mean, the Lord of the Rings movies from the early 2000s, it seems like there's 20,000 characters on screen at a time, but there's just something about having real guys there. And you benefited from having armies of reenactors, which, as you pointed out in your previous interview, made life a lot simpler because you didn't have to wardrobe them. They came with their wardrobe.
Yeah, and in Gettysburg, there's no CGI of character multiplication. There's CGI used to remove the contrails of jet planes or some wires in some scenes, but that's it. We use it for removal, not for adding. We had in Pickett's Charge, there's 5,000 soldiers, more than about 5,000 plus soldiers in the shop. We had them for that week. We had 1 week. It was obviously planned well in advance. And that's 5,000 breakfasts, 5,000 lunches. We had a whole encampment. The rest of the schedule, Pickett's Charge was like the last week of the Confederate schedule before we went into the Yankee schedule. We had allotted 6 days for it because we didn't know how many days we might get have rain, and we were never going to get those 5,000 people back. So we scheduled 6 days. We had like the first 3 days were the essential, got to have these shots to tell the story. We concentrated on those. And then the next 3 days were, it would be nice to have this, then it would be nice to have this, it would be fabulous to have this. Well, as it turned out, it didn't rain for the whole 6 days. So we shot everything we wanted to shoot. And as a result, it's quite a sequence. And one of the critics, I think he was trying to have fun with us. One of the film critics, when the film came out, he said, Pickett's Charge looked like it was filmed in real time. And he's not far off, because, you know, in reality it was a couple of hours, but it's like 20 minutes in the film. So that worked out. And the rest of the shoot before Pickett's Charge and after Pickett's Charge, we had many thousands of reenactors in those other scenes. In Gods and Generals 10 years later, we did use some CGI multiplication forces just in one scene when the federal troops are crossing the big open terrain in the Battle of Fredericksburg, which was kind of the equivalent of Pickett's Charge, only now it's the Yankees charging up toward the Stonewall. In that scene, we had thousands of reenactors, but a couple of the long shots we augmented with CGI.
One of the things that I find so incongruous about fighting in those days is it's the summer and they're in those woolen uniforms. And I guess one of the advancements in warfare over the ages is making the soldiers more comfortable. And yet when you reenacted it in 92, once again, they had to wear those woolen uniforms. So you probably had a lot of bottled water on the set.
Yes, we had a lot of water, and we had a lot of assistance standing by to run out with the Gatorade in the water. As I said earlier, it was a very hot, humid summer, and our greatest threat health-wise was from heat exhaustion. And all those reenactors and the actors had these woolen uniforms on. It was real clothing, you know, it wasn't Halloween stuff, so it was real clothing, and it was punishing. So every now and then a reenactor would just collapse. And when that happens, when someone collapses from heat exhaustion, wherever you are, you have to immediately stabilize the person where they are. It's life-threatening. So all during the shoot, we had an ambulance on the set, paramedics all the whole time. But during the Pickett's Charge week, when we had all those thousands, we had two ambulances, two paramedic teams on the set all the time. So that if a reenactor collapsed, we just stopped shooting. We stopped, ambulance rushed out to the set. The person was stabilized exactly where they were. Once they were stabilized, they're taken in the ambulance, taken to the hospital. When the ambulance left the set, we resumed filming. That was what we did. And I think that happened three or four times over the whole course of the shoot. You don't mess with heat exhaustion. If you don't treat it properly right away, it could be fatal.
And we're coming to the end of the interview, but I want to ask you, you mentioned earlier that there is a new director's cut of Gettysburg. Is this longer than the 4-hour one we saw in 93?
Yes. The new cut, the director's cut, is about roughly 20, 21 minutes longer than when we were doing the director's cut of Gods and Generals for the 150th celebration of the Civil War. So that was in, as we know, in 2011. So in the year before, 2010, Warners and Ted Turner organized getting the director's cut of Gods and Generals ready. So I went out to the Warner lot, and I spent 6 months with the post crew putting that Gods and Generals director's cut together. And that's about an hour and 15 minutes longer than the film that was released. But while we were doing that, one of the executives at Warners came over to me and said, we should release the director's cut of Gettysburg too. And I go, what? There's no director's cut of Gettysburg. That was it. We released the whole thing. He said, no, there's a longer version. I said, what? So he showed me the longer version. I completely forgotten that even Gettysburg at 4 hours and 15 minutes, I guess, the theatrical release, we had a longer cut because we were making cuts. Oh, wow. So it's Buford going through the town of Gettysburg. There's a scene with General Ewell. Well, it's great stuff. So after we finished the director's cut of Gods and Generals, we finished. I stayed another few weeks and we refinished, because, you know, you have to remix and recolor and we finished the director's cut of Gettysburg. And that wasn't, that kind of lay dormant until really lately, like last year. So that is finally available in digital DVD, digital streaming or DVD on Amazon and other platforms. And they're both now, both films are available in their director's cut versions. And I have to say, immodestly, I guess, that the director's cut of both films are better than the theatrical versions, because we're now in the post streaming age. And we all know that if we're really interested in a story and it's well done and you're looking at great performances, more is really better.
No, absolutely. Well, this has been wonderful, Ron. I mean, I love going back to this film because it's just a true treasure. It's just something that sits on my shelf like just Lawrence of Arabia and Saving Private Ryan, and just one of the true classics. And thank you for once again sharing your thoughts about it.
Stephen, thanks so much for your invitation. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. You've been listening to and watching In Certain Cases to Saturday Night at the Movies. I'm your host, Steve Rubin. Our producer's Ben Shrewsbury. See you next time.